Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week my very special guest is actor Martin Sheen, best known for his performances in the films Badlands and Apocalypse Now and in the television series The West Wing from 1999 to 2006, for which he won a Golden Globe and two Screen Actors Guild Awards. In addition to film and television, Sheen has become notable for his activism in liberal politics. He credits the Marianists at the University of Dayton as a major influence on his public activism. Sheen is known for his robust support of liberal political causes such as opposition to United States military actions. Sheen has resisted calls to run for office, saying, "There's no way that I could be the president. You can't have a pacifist in the White House. I'm an actor. This is what I do for a living." Martin Sheen is an honorary trustee of the Dayton International Peace Museum, and he kindly joins us on the phone now from California. Hello, Martin Sheen.
Hello, Helen. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty tired. How are you?
Well, I'm not so bad.
That's
Happy Easter to you.
Oh, yeah, happy Easter to you, too. Did you have some Easter eggs?
Well, always.
Yeah.
They're a great delight. Yes, I love Easter eggs, and I love Easter because it's a time of renewal, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. And I know for you it's very profound, being a deeply committed Catholic, which is kind of how we first met, isn't it, Martin? Can you remember how we first met?
Well, I've known you for so long. I can't remember not knowing you, Helen.
Oh, go on. Well,
how long? It was here in the States,
yes.
Am I right?
Yes. I'll tell you when it was, I think, that I first met you was at Los Alamos Labs, where on one of numerous protests, you were there and the police had set up an artificial line beyond which one must not move. And you went to the line with other people and you knelt down and said the Hail Mary. You got up, walked across the line, and they handcuffed you to take you to jail. But then you said you couldn't go to jail because you're already committed to the to be president in the West Wing series. You had
Well, that's very close to the occasion at Los Alamos. I remember that very well.
Yeah.
Amy Goodman was there, incidentally,
yeah,
reporting on it.
Yeah.
And my dear friend and peacemaker, Father John Deere, was arrested with us as well, and a young Berrigan, one of the daughters of Philip Berrigan, was arrested with us as well.
Oh, Catholics.
And you had everything right except the prayer.
Oh,
I think it was an Our Father and not a Hail Mary.
Sorry. Oh, well, I can't always get things right, Martin.
Well, we always say the Our Father when we cross the line in these places.
Yeah.
And usually they arrest us before we get to the line, "Forgive us our trespasses."
As we forgive them that trespass against us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're usually in handcuffs by then.
And do you think it helps to say the Our Father when you're doing such an action?
Well, it certainly helps me. You know, I have to confess that I don't really have a great deal of interest in politics per se, because I don't think that politicians, I'm not saying all public servants are like this, but politicians generally are meant to serve a certain constituency, and so that they're not always free to vote with their conscience or act from their heart. So I, while I have supported a lot of men and women who run for public office, I don't really have the kind of faith that I have in grassroots movements, which are born of the people and really make the change. There are very few great things that have ever been accomplished by politicians in the beginning. They're usually, it's brought to their attention to do something, but it's done by people like yourself who agitate
and educate.
Yes. Agitate and educate people to what's going on, and then hopefully you can get people in positions of responsibility to do something about it. But I think in my own country, in the in the 60s, the civil rights movement was not the brevet of politicians. There was no one in public life who initiated the civil rights legislation or anything to do with civil rights. It was Reverend King and the nonviolent movement for civil rights, the civil rights movement, you know. And he never held a political office in his life. And it's the same for unionism, you know. The union started from the workers, the people who suffered the most at the hands of abusive employers.
Yeah, that's really how a decent society has grown up, with a decent minimum wage and rights for workers. Otherwise, it was virtually a feudalistic system in the 1800s and the like until the unions got together. Yeah.
Yes, it was. And the unions formed the middle class.
Yeah.
And the wealthy people never understand the importance of unionism, how important it is for the majority of the people to be educated and to have a stake in the future. So that they have to have a wage and a working condition that their children can benefit from their labor and carry on the society. And in fact, they still don't get it today, the importance of unionism.
You move amongst probably very wealthy people living where you live and the like, Martin. Do you talk to them about this? Tell us what their attitude is at the moment about how particularly the American society is going.
Well, I moved in this neighborhood long before it became a desirable place to live. In fact, we moved to Malibu because it was the cheapest place to live at the time, back in the early 1970s, and we've been here ever since. But our primary concern was trying to find a big enough place for our family and a place that we could afford. So the neighborhood grew out of proportion after we moved in, when the land became so valuable, otherwise I could not have afforded it. But I don't really talk to a lot of wealthy people about many of the issues that are going on in our culture, because I'm so involved in the issues myself, and you don't see a lot of wealthy people on picket lines or protest movements. Yeah. They usually have a lot more at stake, so I don't know that many wealthy people, frankly. And I don't have a lot of close relationships with them. So, and that's not by choice per se. It's just the path that I have chosen to go does not attract a lot of wealthy people, because sometimes the path I go is very challenging and very costly. I'm asked at times to debate some of these extremists, these right-wing people, the Tea Party people, and the extreme far right wing in my country, and I refuse to debate with them because they make a living doing what they're doing, and what I do is costly. So I don't like to feed into their to their channel.
Yeah, I know it gives me a pain in the neck because I don't earn any money for what I do either, and yet, yeah. Well, anyway, that's beside the point. Do you still go to picket lines now? What are your main activities?
Oh, I still do.
Now?
Yeah, we're supporting this the union movement in the state of Wisconsin, and then in my home state of Ohio.
Oh, good.
Where they have blocked what had been fought for over 50 years. Bargaining. And it seems to become, it seems now to be a national movement to go after the unions and the union pensions and their right to collective bargaining. It's a big mistake. And in fact, it's backfired in Wisconsin, and it's starting to turn around in Ohio.
Well, what do we do about those fellows, the Koch brothers? I don't know how you pronounce their name, K-O-C-H.
No, you got it, yeah.
The Koch brothers.
They are the biggest polluters because they are the coal industry,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes.
And these guys got a lock on it, even in Congress, you know, the people that they have supported and sent to Congress, and then a lot of the people that are on the committees that would have a say in EPA regulations and so forth, and regulations of the pollutants, you know. Coal is the biggest polluter on the planet.
Oh, I know, except for nuclear power, Martin.
Nuclear power, yes, of course, is the worst and the deadliest. Mm. It's quicker. You know, it'll kill you quicker than coal. But coal is you know, future generations are going to be affected by it in the same kind of deadly health ways, you know.
I know. It's global warming is upon us, and random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time is upon us from the whole of the nuclear activities. And, I did an interview this morning, actually, in Southern California, and I really said, I quoted Einstein and said, he said, the splitting of the atom changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Thus, we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. And I said the profundity of that statement has really, really never been taken on board. And really, Martin, I think it's much up to the women now. 53% of the population is women.
Yeah.
And we need to harness the passion that a lioness has to protect her cubs.
Yes.
And remember the Saturday Evening Post cartoon, which used to say, an aroused woman is unstoppable?
Yes, I believe it.
Yeah, we've got to arouse the women to take over. I mean, we really need a revolution now of Gandhian proportions.
I quite agree. And, you know, Dostoevsky said the world will be saved by beauty. He meant women.
Did he?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Very clearly, yes.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, we had a revolution in the 80s, Martin. That was, I believe, the second American Revolution. When I first came to America in 78 to live, almost everyone said to me, it's better to be dead than red. And I said, what, you'd rather die in a nuclear war? Oh, yeah, we don't want to be communist. So then I got together 23,000 doctors and we started dropping the bomb on various major U.S. cities and vaporizing everyone. And within 5 years, 80% of the Americans rose up and said, we will not put up with this. We need to get rid of nuclear weapons. Now, it was partly helped by Pat Kingsley. Do you know Pat Kingsley, the agent in Hollywood?
I've heard of her, but I don't know her personally.
She represented Lily Tomlin, Sally Field, and all of these wonderful people. Well, she used to ring up to the Today Show and say, look, or Donahue, and say, I'll give you Lily Tomlin and Sally Field if you'll have Helen Caldicott on too for an hour. And they didn't want a boring old Australian doctor talking about nuclear war. I mean, that's bad for ratings. They can't sell their hemorrhoid cream if they're, you know, talking about nuclear war. But they loved having Sally and Lily. And she did it all over the country. And through that, we were able to educate the majority of Americans about the medical dangers of nuclear war. I mean, you've got to have access to the media, and it's damn hard now, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and now it's even more so. But, you know, there are many new venues, you know, with the cable TV and satellite radio and such. You know, there are so many opportunities now to get a message heard and get a message seen these days that we didn't have before. But, of course, there's so many more of us.
That's right.
You know, and so, you know, the message is that much more urgent these days. And we don't have to look far. Look at, in Japan, this horrible catastrophe. And you know what's extraordinary? It's already off, not just the front pages, but it's off the back pages. There's nothing in this morning's paper, and there hasn't been anything in the Los Angeles Times within the last week that I can remember about the catastrophe in Japan, the nuclear catastrophe. And that's just the civilian catastrophic emergency, and it's still going on.
Yeah.
And I don't even think the people in Japan are as well informed as they need to be about what's going on in that complex.
Oh, no, there's a big cover-up, absolutely, globally, by the nuclear industry in Japan.
And incidentally, isn't this the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl?
Yes.
This very day. Was it yesterday?
Or the day before. I just taped a week ago in London a CNN international debate with three people from the corporate world, HSBC Bank and someone else. Do you know they were talking about profits in the market? And I said, and we were discussing Chernobyl. And I said, are we going to kill the earth for money? That's where their heads are, Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
To go back, you know, you did have a wonderful president in our lifetimes, and that was FDR.
Yes. And we had a few good tries since then and a few good men in some areas, you know, that made some extraordinary changes in my lifetime.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you were once president, and we absolutely adored you. Everyone was addicted to you.
I was known affectionately as the acting president, I'm known as the former acting president.
I love it. You know who I loved was Mrs. Who was your secretary who got killed in the car crash?
Mrs. Landingham.
Wasn't she gorgeous?
Oh, I adored her. She's now a big star on Housewives, Desperate Housewives.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And that she was your mentor at school in the play. Well,
yes.
I'm going to ask you a fairly serious question now, and you don't have to answer it, Martin Sheehan, but I want you to give your assessment of President Obama.
Well, the fact that he's there is a testament to our willingness to change, and as a nation, as a culture, it was an unprecedented step that he was elected and is so revered. I have, you know, a lot of reservations which I find hard to talk about publicly because I don't want to sound like I don't support him. I do support him. And give thanks and praise to God every day that he's there, and that he hopefully will be there for another term, from 2012 on. So that said, there are of course many issues that I'm uncomfortable with. That I wish that he move more quickly to become involved in. You know, one of the main issues that I'm involved in is the immigration issue here, how disaster a policy the federal government has on immigration currently, and the debate seems to have been stifled. And he, during the campaign, was very forthright about acknowledging the problem and promising to fix it. And there's been very, very little movement on that. But again, that being said, he's working with a Congress and a very, very conservative media on the whole that stifles so much of his weight, and so many of his initiatives are not implemented. And he finds himself in these trench fights just over health care, for example, which took up almost a full year of his administration, and with the constant battles over, you know, the implementation of a badly needed health reform, and they're still battling on it, and some of it is even going to court because there's such a profit margin in the pharmaceuticals and the healthcare system and the hospitals and the whole medical profession, not the least of which are the pharmaceutical companies, that there's so much at stake. And so a lot of his time and energy and focus has been spent trying to get these incremental changes through in a very hard-nosed Congress. But not just there, but in the culture itself. So much of his healthcare legislation was tarnished in the media, you know, the right-wing media and the conservative media, to such an extent that it made it impossible to understand what really was at stake. You know, he was trying to foster a healthcare that was affordable to all Americans, all of our citizens. And, you know, just that one issue alone. Mm. But, you know, you could go on, and we're never going to be satisfied with the whole picture, no matter who's president. Even the most ideal president is going to give us pause in so many areas. But for me, the health care, the immigration issue, of course, the nuclear issue, you know, the big oil, you know, now they're screaming they need to drill, and they're going to get pretty much what they want because of the gasoline prices now and the oil crises. We're told now that we need to drill and become less dependent on, you know, foreign foreign oil. So, gosh, there's any number of issues that you could find fault with his administration, and I'm certainly not blind to that. But what I keep saying to people who complain about him, I say, you know, the first thing we have to accept that he's not them. You know, we just went through 8 years with them, you know, Mr. Bush and that group, you know, that wanted the, you know, that pretty much had their sway since 9/11 in every area and made a mess of it, as we know, and we're still trying to clean up much of that. So he's not them, thank God. And on many issues and many promises he has delivered, and we're just learning how difficult it is, even in that most powerful of positions, to make the slightest incremental change and lead a whole culture in a new direction. And our nuclearism, of course, is part of that. But he can't even get the treaty, you know, with nuclear weapons reduction that he did with Russia. That has not been confirmed yet by the Senate.
Oh, it's not been ratified? I thought it was ratified, except Senator Kyle didn't vote for it.
Certain portions of it have, but the whole thing about allowing for inspections, you know, that's still a very touchy issue here. It's a very nationalistic issue, you know, and it is for the Russians too, I guess.
Oh, less so.
But,
for
you
them.
Know, we're one of seven nuclear nations, and, you know, if you look at the Mideast and or you look at Asia and you look at India and Pakistan alone, these are two nuclear-armed nations that are constantly at each other's throat, and they live on the same border. You know, and we supply an awful lot of help and a lot of revenue and a lot of aid to both of those countries. And if I was to have my wish granted, for that whole region, is I would tell both countries that until they nuclear disarm completely, that I would have no trade with them, and I would sanction both of them.
I'm interviewing the former president, Martin Sheehan.
The former acting president.
No. I agree with that, but, you know, of the 25,000 or so nuclear weapons in the world, Russia and America own 97% of them.
Yeah.
No, and they're the real rogue states. They're the real axis of evil, holding the world at ransom every single second of every single day, when we could have a global nuclear war and the end of all life on the planet. That still holds true as it did during the Cold War. Nothing's changed. So therefore, it would be hypocritical and as seen as such by many other nuclear nations for America to say, okay, you're not getting anything anywhere unless you get rid of your nuclear weapons, when America has the majority of nuclear weapons actually of any nation in the world.
That's true. And the delivery systems as well that can send them just about anywhere in the world.
Oh, 6,000 miles in 20 minutes. And
yes, exactly.
You know,
the nuclear capability of submarines as well. So,
yes.
And you know, they can move them around.
I read yesterday that in the Dakotas, where many of the silos are, with a single Minuteman III missile with three huge hydrogen bombs in it, and you can see when you fly over the Dakotas north and south, you can look down and see these missile silos scattered all over the place, hundreds of them. But there's been so much snow this year, and it's now melting and starting to flood the missile silos.
Uh-huh.
And I think to myself, well, that's a good idea. But they want to make sure
that you could have a meltdown in the silo.
Well, no. No, you couldn't. No, you just, as we'd say in Australia, bugger up the mechanism to launch the missile, and that's not a bad thing.
No, this is true, but they are, you know, they are armed.
Oh, I know. Three huge hydrogen bombs, each targeted specifically and accurately on three different targets. I mean, it's...
Yes, and well, the MX-12 is the 12th, you know.
But they, yeah, I know. But did that? They didn't build the MX. They were going to, but didn't they cancel it, Martin?
No, that is a delivery system that was high, was a big priority during the Cold War.
Yeah,
and it's not, you know, it's not so much. It doesn't feel necessary for our defense these days.
Defense. I hate that word, defense. I mean, I've renamed the Department of Defense the Department of Death because you people over there spend more than $1 trillion a year on death. That's true.
Yeah, I know, it's more than that.
It's just unbelievable. And, you know, as a doctor myself working at Harvard, with patients dying of cystic fibrosis, do you know, in the 70s and 80s, parents couldn't afford antibiotics for their dying children. And I come from a country which is basically socialistic, which is what Jesus was. He was a socialist, you know.
Yes, he was.
More difficult for a rich man to
community organizer.
More difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. And we've got a totally free healthcare system. And I can't. The American people have been so brainwashed to think that that's, you know, a form of communism or some absolute rhubarb, whereas you've got a socialistic death system.
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm. Well, this whole, paranoia about our own security, that's another word that...
Security.
It's bandied about. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're insecure totally when the Russians are still targeting you with thousands of hydrogen bombs, which, you know, there are 40 H-bombs targeted on New York, Martin, and about 60 on Washington as we speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know it was so many. It wouldn't take that many. Somebody ought to tell them it wouldn't take that many. Why don't you get rid of at least 39?
Well, because they built so many and there's such a redundancy that they just over-target things, and so does America. You know, it's
that's true. Well, you know, it's part of our economy as well. You know, we support the whole military-industrial complex. You know, and that's really where most of our eggs are stored. Our whole economy is based in large measure on related industries. You know, to the defense industry.
Well, it's not defense. We mustn't use that word defense anymore. It's a euphemism. It's like we had to destroy the village to save it, that sort of euphemistic language. It's not defense. It's killing. It's death. It's destruction. Martin, I want to ask you what stimulated you in the first place to become so deeply involved in social issues correlated with your deep, deep religious feelings and beliefs?
Well, as you may know, I'm a Catholic, a practicing Catholic. I returned to the church after a long absence in 1981. In May of that year, I was in Paris. I'd gone through some deeply transforming personal things, and I came out at the other end realizing that I needed to get involved in a spirituality, and so I rejoined the Catholic Church. But I didn't come back to the faith of my childhood, where I just did everything that I was told and lived mostly in fear and dread, you know.
And guilt.
I came back to the radical action church of liberation theology. And in the United States, I became close to the Berrigan brothers, both Dan and Philip Berrigan. And they began to lead me in the way of radical action. Radical meaning root. It's the Latin word for root, and it's how the church started. And so it is a road of social justice. You know, the Old Testament calls for us to do justice, to love greatly, and to walk humbly. And so that's kind of been my focus. And I have come to all of the issues that I'm involved with, all of the social justice issues, including nuclearism, on the level of spirituality. And so that, you know, I the bottom line is I don't get involved in protest or any of the actions that I do with the belief that I can change anyone's mind or make the weapons disappear. I do it basically for myself because I cannot not do it and be myself. I can't truly be honest with myself if I don't speak up and stand there, you know. And do it nonviolently, and do it, you know, with a sense of self-effacement, you know. And so that's basically what my mission has been. Is to stand there when I'm asked to participate in a social justice issue, whether it's, as I say, nuclearism or homelessness or immigration or any one of the issues that we're confronted with these days, and to speak truth to power, to do it nonviolently, and to actually do it joyfully as well.
Mm. Well, what exactly then, let's get down to the roots, from a basis of spirituality, how do you define that, Martin, as just a standalone definition, but also in relationship to the world and your place in it?
Well, you know, our nation began a terrible road to self-destruction after the war, when it began to arm to the teeth, you know, starting with the atom bombs and moving to thermonuclear and a whole massive conglomeration of weapons and weapons delivery systems that lasted all the way up into the Reagan era. They still are in place today. You know, we have so many sophisticated systems and so many weapons to be delivered by them that it's just mind-boggling the amount of weapons, the amount of money, the energy that is spent, the risk to our health and the risk to destroying the planet. And we still stockpile these weapons. We have reduced them in large measure over the years. And just recently, you know, President Obama concluded a nuclear weapons reduction treaty with the Russians. It's not yet been fully ratified by the Congress, but the basic plan has a reduction of the weapons. But still, in all, we have enough stockpiled nuclear weapons and delivery systems to destroy the world dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And we're just one nuclear nation of seven in the
world.
With
the press of a button. I mean, I don't know why we haven't had a nuclear war yet. America's still got 2,500 weapons on hair trigger alert that take 20 to 30 minutes to hit Russia. You know, New York City is targeted with 40 H-bombs from Russia and Washington 60. It's just all madness. But you didn't really get to the root of my question. How do you define your spirituality, Martin? What is spirituality to you? And then how is it applied to the world? I can see you.
On this one issue alone, I feel that we have developed a new religion, a false idols in these weapons, and this religion is called nuclearism. We worship these weapons. We count on them for our safety, our defense, as it were. And they are false gods, and they are a reflection of evil, and they rob the poor, and they endanger the world, and they foreclose the future. And so they have to be called what they are, and they have to be expelled from our culture. And you know, of course, that's a long and arduous journey, and it's not one that will happen in my lifetime, and maybe not even in my children's lifetime. But it has to begin somewhere. We have to put a name on these things. These are false gods. These are an invitation to total darkness.
Doesn't it say in the Old Testament, thou shalt not worship false gods?
That's it. That's the whole point. That's exactly where
it
is. So
America's got two false gods, money and nuclear weapons. And I think the interesting thing is, as a doctor, I always want to know why, how. Until Jonas Salk and Sabine discovered the poliovirus, well, it was Sabine, we didn't know what caused it and we didn't know how to cure it. When we found out what caused it, or what we call the etiology, then we could proceed to cure it. Okay, so what is the pathology, and I would say fairly specifically in some men's minds that worship nuclearism, and I've been looking at this lately, it's fascinating, in the limbic system, in the reptilian midbrain, two emotions release dopamine. Now, dopamine is a lovely feeling you get after an orgasm, that lovely, gorgeous feeling. And dopamine chemically resembles morphine or opium. And the two instincts that, or feelings that trigger dopamine release in the male brain are violence and sex.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that interesting? And I think that violence, I mean, the ultimate violence is hydrogen explosions and blowing up the planet.
Yeah.
And I think some men get off on this. They trip on it.
Yeah. There's a very popular phrase still to this day, you know, nuke them, bomb them into the Stone Age and so forth, when we're talking about our enemies, you know. Mm. Yeah. But we're called to love our enemies, aren't we?
Well, love thine enemies.
And then we still call ourselves a Christian nation. You're talking about why they exist in our culture and why does, you know, our leadership feel that we need them. It is a reflection of our paranoia, and it is also a reflection of our bankruptcy, you know, our moral bankruptcy. Yeah. And it goes hand in hand with the bankruptcy that these weapons have cost us.
Yeah.
You know, Reagan brought the Soviet Union to its knees by outspending them in the arms race. They couldn't keep up. That was a major reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, and even Mikhail Gorbachev had confessed that. They couldn't keep up with the United States. And along that point, I want to make one point that I understand that very few people are aware of, even and particularly in the United States, and it's a great shame. I was in England in 1986, in April of 1986. I was doing a play there. I was there for about 6 months. And during that time, in April, Chernobyl occurred. Mm. And I recall that it was discovered on the first day of the week. And I believe it was either the Swiss...
The Swedes
thought it was them. They came in after the weekend and said, oh, my God, we've had a meltdown. And they checked, and of course it wasn't them. They discovered that it was in Chernobyl, so it belonged to the Soviets near Ukraine. And they immediately alerted the Soviets, and the Soviet says yes, and it happened either Friday night or Saturday morning. Now, as soon as the news got out to the world, and that was on Monday morning, I was in England at the time, as I say, and the cloud had already made its way over Western Europe. So President Reagan was in Japan at the time at a conference. And when the news was announced that Chernobyl had happened, he condemned the Soviets for knowing about it for the whole weekend and not saying anything. Well, in fact, the United States knew about it the instant it happened via spy satellites. Mm. They thought initially that it was an above-ground test, which would have been against the non-proliferation agreement. And so they thought, wait a minute, it's happening in a civilian area. It's in the middle of a city. It can't be above ground test. Mm. And so it proved to be a power meltdown at a nuclear plant in a place called Chernobyl. Now, we knew 48 hours before the United States, before the United States and the world supposedly knew about it. The Soviets, of course, knew about it 48 hours before, and they kept their mouths shut about it. They were embarrassed and in a great hurry to try and fix it and cover it up. There's no doubt or question about that. But what about the American response? Mm. And what about the American responsibility to have alerted the world? We didn't. Reagan kept it quiet, and he let the Soviets stew in it. And his crime was an equal measure to the Soviets' crime of keeping it quiet until the destruction had already made its way across the Western Europe and other parts of the world. So that's part of the nationalism and the paranoia that controls governments when they're dealing with these meltdowns and this out-of-control nuclearism. And I have a fear that the same thing, and you'll have to tell me because you're closer to Japan right now than we are, but, you know, it's off the front page, as we said earlier. And it's not even on the second or third pages. It's nowhere in our national press these days. We're getting absolutely nothing on what's happening at Fukushima, if that's the way you pronounce it there. And so we know that there's no announcement that they've solved the problem or covered it up, but we're very wary of what's going on. And it is bringing to mind the awful situation that we went through with Chernobyl and the information or the lack of information surrounding it. So I just want to share that with you, that the Americans were just as responsible for keeping the news of Chernobyl out of the global knowledge as much as the Soviets were.
I'm interviewing Martin Sheehan, former president of the United States.
I'm the former acting president now.
Now, Martin, two things this brings to mind. One, you said we won't abolish nuclear weapons in your lifetime or, you know, maybe your children's. That's not true. You know, Reagan and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik in 1987, and over a weekend, two mere mortals almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons between
the two
countries.
Yes, in fact, Reagan wanted to get rid of all of them.
Oh, no, and Gorbachev did too, absolutely. Yeah. And they got stuck on Reagan's stupid notion of Star Wars, which Edward Teller introduced him to. And so there is a precedent. We can agree, you know, to abolish nuclear weapons. And in fact, when Clinton was elected, we handed him a mandate on a silver platter. 80% of Americans wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons. He could have flown over in Air Force One to meet Boris Yeltsin, a really out-of-it alcoholic, totally compliant, and said, okay, Boris, here's a treaty. We're going to abolish nuclear weapons bilaterally, and we own 97% of all of them in the world, within 5 years. But Clinton was intimidated by the Pentagon. He'd smoked some dope. He hadn't gone to Vietnam. He didn't have any moral fiber or backbone. His legacy is that the weapons remain on hair trigger alert in Russia and America, and we could be blown up tonight. That's number one. Number two, I want to say I met with Reagan in the White House for an hour and a quarter. I don't know if you know this.
I didn't.
No, well, I met his daughter Patty in the Playboy Mansion of all places. Hugh Hefner was excerpting a book called With Enough Shovels about FEMA and how, you know, if there's a nuclear attack, you get out your trusty shovel and you dig a hole, you know, 6 feet long and 3 feet.
I remember that.
And get in the hole and put two doors on top of it and dirt and the guy says,
and you'll be fine.
The dirt that does it. Yeah. So I had to address a whole lot of film stars together with Paul Newman about this. I'd never met Paul. And anyway, I went up and said hello, and he kissed my hand, and so I nearly fell at his feet because he's so gorgeous.
He was a lovely guy.
Oh, and then I gave him a talk, and this tall, willowy, dark-haired girl came up. She said, "I think you're the only person on earth who can change my father's mind. Would you meet him?" I said, "Sure, but, you know, I don't want Mies Baker or Diva there. I'll see him alone or not at all." So she rang me and said, "We've got an appointment at the end of his working day." And I said, "What time is that?" She said, 4 p.m. So that left me a bit bewildered. So we got into, you know, the Secret Service cars and into the Southern Portico and the downstairs library in which there wasn't a book. He came sort of in all doddery. He didn't know where to sit. I shook his hand and said, "Hello, Mr. President." So I showed him where to sit. And we embarked on an hour and a quarter long conversation. I had more time alone with him than any other person in his 8 years of presidency.
He knew
nothing. I just finished my book, Missile Envy, and I was just pouring with facts and figures. So everything he said, I'd stop him and correct him. And you know when he got anxious, he'd get a red flush on his cheek?
Then
I held his hand to reassure him. So half the time I held his hand and quickly established a doctor-patient relationship with him.
God love you. What an extraordinary story.
I established his IQ to be about 100, which is average, and that takes in all the mentally retarded people, etc. And I came out saying that I thought he had impending Alzheimer's, so my diagnosis was correct. But it was the scariest thing, Martin. I mean, what I'm thinking as I talk to you, can't you use your acting prowess and abilities and contacts to do a film about the present nuclear situation and about America's role? And I mean, it could be a little bit satirical, which gets people involved. They love that. But you're so good, and you were once the acting president, and by God, does the world ever need to be woken up again?
Yeah. Well, you know, since 9/11, there's been a lot of talk about what would happen if any number of terrorist cells around the country and around the world were to get a hold of, you know, either the material or a real weapon.
Or if they destroyed nuclear reactors, which are targets. And apparently Al-Qaeda have said, and it was just yesterday it was announced that they'd killed bin Laden, that the Al-Qaeda said if Osama was killed, that they would target nuclear reactors in America. And I wouldn't put it past them.
No, they're absolute lunatics,
But
and
America
we're lunatics
was lunatic.
For having the,
that's right.
For having most of them. I know what you mean.
I want to say, have you ever watched Doc Martin? Martin Sheen? Have you ever seen the English film Doc Martin?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
no.
Look, you've got to get it. Anyway, there's this English doctor, and he's got Asperger's, and he's very funny with his patients. Everyone loves him, but they drive him crazy because he can't relate to anyone. And he's in love with this girl called Louise, who's a local school teacher, and she says, "Martin?" And every time I talk to you, I think, "Martin?"
Well, would you mind if I said hello vis-a-vis this interview to some friends in Australia?
We'd love that, Martin.
Okay, just give you a little backstory. My son and I, that is Emilio, were in Spain about a year and a half ago filming a movie called The Way, which opens, incidentally, next Friday in the UK and Ireland, and later on here in the United States, and I hope you get it in Australia before the end of the year.
We will.
But at any rate, it's a story of a father and son on pilgrimage across the Pyrenees in France to northern Spain and all the way over to Galicia, on the pilgrimage of Santiago de Compostela. And while we were filming, we met a couple from, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Bannockburn, Victoria, Australia. Does that ring a bell in Victoria?
No.
B-A-N-N-O-C-K-B-U-R-N.
Never heard of it, and I grew up in Victoria. Anyway, go on.
Okay. Well, at any rate, this lovely family were on pilgrimage. This husband and wife, Gary and Libby Jewson, and they had a few years earlier lost their daughter Melanie in an accident, and they were making pilgrimage in her honor.
Oh.
And we made contact in Santiago, and we stayed in touch ever since. And they have started a foundation in her name. It's the Melanie Jewson Foundation there. And they asked me to be a sponsor and of patronage. Mm. And I've agreed to do that recently. And so that's what's going on with them. And I just want to just remember them and say hello vis-a-vis you, Helen. And I'm very grateful to you for that.
Oh, that's very sweet of you, Martin Sheehan. How long does it take to do the Compostela pilgrimage?
Well, it depends on how fit you are.
Yeah.
And how long you. It is a distance of about 800 kilometers from the little village of Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port in the Pyrenees over to the first Spanish city is Roncesvalles, and then across the north of Spain all the way over. You'd go through Pamplona, Burgos, León, and finally into Galicia and to Santiago, which is St. James, of course, where they believe the remains of the apostle are buried in that cathedral. And so the 800 kilometers can usually be covered in 5 to 6 weeks by normal standards, but someone my age and my condition, I would say closer to 8 or 9 weeks.
And is it a wonderful experience? Is beautiful scenery and ancient?
It's extraordinary because you're going to go across a part of Spain that very few people know.
Yeah.
The only really known city along the route is Pamplona, and that's famous because of the running of the bulls
of
and all
course.
The lunatics that get in their way.
Yeah, all the crazy men with testosterone poisoning to their reptilian midbrains. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, you wanted to ask me about what motivates me, Martin Sheehan.
Yes, because we were talking the other day, and you mentioned that you don't have a specific religious affiliation. So tell me about yourself. What motivates you to speak truth to power and to stand against nuclearism?
I grew up with agnostic parents or atheists. I was a little girl and I used to dress myself up and go to Sunday school at various religions looking for God, but I often just found cruelty, so that didn't work. I've always been fascinated by physiology. If you drink water, where does the urine come from? You know, what makes a snail tick? And when I entered medicine, I just absolutely love it. That is my religion, the life process. But I've always been terrified of death because I had a near-death experience when I was 18 months and got otitis media.
You remember it?
Yeah, I do. I do. Because,
you do?
Yeah, because I was left in a cold home for 2 weeks while my mother, who was very pregnant, and my father went for a holiday and it was cold in Melbourne. And I got middle ear infection, and I remember being placed on a barouche and taken along and held down with two big arms covered with black hair and this ghastly mask put on my face, breathing this awful stuff. It was either ether or chloroform. And I thought I was dying. And ever since then, I've been terrified of death. So I thought, well, I never studied in biology. I always came 100% because it's kind of me. But I thought if I did medicine, I could have more control over death. But, of course, I just got more differential diagnoses. If I got a lump in my neck or something, and I could be dead in 3 weeks. That didn't help.
Yeah.
But my religion, and I took the Hippocratic Oath at 17, I guess that's like becoming a nun. I'm a medical nun, and I'm totally devoted to medicine. That is my vocation. That's where I live. And I worship it. I worship the sanctity of life. And it's funny, the other day I live in a little fishing village in New South Wales and the stars are unbelievable. I went out one night and I looked up there and I thought, I'm part of that. And suddenly my fear of death went. I was part of that before I was conceived. I'm part of the whole constellation when I die, and I felt really good about that. But so what motivates me is the truth. In medicine, you're not scared of telling a patient the truth. I'm not courageous. I just speak truth. That's all. And these people who are in politics, they are scientifically and medically illiterate. How dare they be? They have their hands in the pockets of all the corporations who fund them. And I'm sick of it. I am here to save lives. I'm a conservative. I'm for conserving life on the planet. And so, therefore, I'm never scared. I've had 8 death threats. And in fact, you know, some were pretty serious, I think.
Yes.
But, you know, what's my life compared to maybe the only life in the whole universe? And certainly I'm prepared to die for that. And Martin Luther King said, I'm paraphrasing it, if you don't have something worth dying for, you're not really living.
Yes, he did say that, yes. Mm. And also the word we've learned from the gospel that Jesus tells us that God is worshipped in the truth.
Oh, well, you know, Jesus, we're all sons and daughters of God, and he said that
yes.
too. I think he
yes.
was the greatest psychiatrist who ever lived. And
talking
in parables just causes people to remember his preaching down the ages. But a lot of the other prophets were great too. It's just that Jesus really clicked with people.
Yeah, and it cost him something, you know.
Really?
The value, sometimes what we believe and causes us to do things because of our belief that are risky, and yet if our beliefs have any value at all, they have to lead somewhere that is going to cost us something. Otherwise, we're left to question its value.
Well, I think we're here to serve. And the greatest happiness I ever get is when I spend a whole day with my dying patients, helping them, helping their siblings to adjust, marriage counseling their parents. I'm deeply hungry, terribly tired, and deeply fulfilled. Or when I give a lecture to 2,000 people and I know I've changed their lives that night. I
yeah.
say to my audiences, lift your souls, not your faces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for you.
And, well, you've lifted your soul. Martin, I think we need to work together in the future.
Okay, let's do that.
So we've come to the end of our time.
Okay.
And thank you very much. But hang on the line for a second afterwards because I want to ask you a question.
Okay. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Martin. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was the actor and former acting president, Martin Sheehan, film actor and political activist. Thanks for listening. I'm sure you absolutely loved this interview with the lovely Martin Sheehan. And I look forward to being with you again next week, and I hope you do with me. If you want more information, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Talk to you again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.